From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a National Science Foundation grant is supporting the Milwaukee Public Museum's participation in a coordinated national project. We'll learn more from the museum's research curator. Then we speak with a young pastor working in Milwaukee communities, from the homeless to youth groups.
I think we all see problems. Sometimes we walk over them, and sometimes we just try to, I don't even want to say fix them, we try to work on them. And I'm just a person who just want to work on a few issues that I see. So no, I'm not special at all.
And theater critic and author Chris Jones explains the many things that make Hamilton unique among Broadway shows.
It sort of had a diverse cast, and it made the diversity of its cast, the fact that the Founding Fathers looked like the rest of America, it made it one of its central calling cards. No show on Broadway had ever done that before.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. The National Science Foundation announced this past summer that the Milwaukee Public Museum would be receiving a $4.3 million grant. The money will be used to digitize more than 1.3 million arthropod specimens. Those are things like ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. The museum, along with 25 other institutions across the country, will create the Terrestrial Parasite Tracker. This digital database will help track the spread of diseases like Lyme and West Nile, and it should help people working in human health and safety, agriculture, and wildlife conservation. Dr. Jennifer Zaspel, Milwaukee Public Museum's research curator and the head of zoology, will take the lead on this national project, and she joins me in the studio now. Dr. Jennifer Zaspel, it is a pleasure to meet you and have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You specialize in something that I think a lot of people would probably go, ew, parasites.
Yes, to some extent, I do study creepy crawly parasites. My research program in the context of parasitology is focused on a group of moths that pierces animal tissue and feeds on their blood. So they are vampire moths. And so that's my study system.
I was going to say, those are subjects of a lot of people's nightmares.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
it's
correct.
Like
yeah.
Flesh-piercing moths is one of those things.
Right.
It's a great band name, and it's also something that you think, wow, nature is amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no limit to what you can find in nature, for sure.
So when we use the term parasite, scientifically, what do we mean by that? I mean, that word is used for a lot of different things. But when you, as a professional researcher, what are you talking about when you talk about a parasite?
Right. So a parasite is an organism that lives on or within another organism and benefits from it, typically by gaining nutrition. This relationship is one-sided, and the host doesn't benefit. In many cases, the relationship is harmful to the host.
So I have to ask, why do we think that exists in nature? Why does that kind of one-sided relationship – usually you'd think it would be a beneficial – you know, I think of the birds that ride around on hippos.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Where, you know, the hippo gets something from it too.
Right. It's more of a symbiotic relationship where both members of that partnership benefit in some way. And, you know, with parasites, I don't know that we're exactly sure how those relationships have evolved. It's something that I've spent a lot of time studying over the past, you know, several years. I've always had a keen interest in gaining a better understanding of how distantly related organisms do form these close associations over time. And in terms of, you know, these parasitic relationships, how, you know, one organism can persist at a cost to the other and how that can maintain itself in the environment over time. I think in a lot of ways, depending on the group that you're talking about, is still a bit mysterious.
Yeah, as a layperson in all of this, I've always thought it interesting, say viruses, for example, that kill the host that they enter. I'm thinking AIDS. You know, eventually the host is going to die, and therefore the virus no longer has a home. And so I think
in evolutionary terms, what does that do when that relationship is so toxic that it ends up killing the very thing that you're getting the sustenance from?
Right, absolutely. And I think there is, some literature out there, or certainly it's been hypothesized that parasites can sort of serve as a mechanism for controlling populations, right? And so there is that. But I think evidence to support that claim is still somewhat limited.
So in your job at the Milwaukee Public Museum, what's a day like for you? What are you working on?
Oh, we work on all sorts of things in the collections and research department. So I'm the head of the zoology department, which means I oversee all of the animal collections, vertebrate and invertebrate animal collections at MPM. And so I'm responsible for the care and curation of about 2 to 3 million specimens. We're still inventorying some of our collections to get exact numbers, but that's our estimate. I'm also the director of the Pulicker Butterfly Wing, and so I oversee those operations.
One of the favorite places in the museum, I think, for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what some folks may not know is that in addition to the butterflies that we have in the vivarium, we also have an arthropod rearing lab. And so we have a lot of other live critters in our laboratory spaces, sort of behind the scenes next to the PBW. And then the other hat that I wear is a research curator. And so that means I run a nationally recognized research program. And so I have graduate students, interns, undergraduate students, postdoctoral researchers, and other staff members that work in our various lab spaces with me on a variety of different projects. And so those projects might be the typical things that you would expect from a curator sitting down at the microscope and looking at organisms and, describing new species. But also we do molecular work in my laboratory. And so we look at DNA sequences across different groups of organisms and compare them build relationships and, address questions about their behavior.
So one of the cool things that has just happened is the National Science Foundation has recognized you and the Milwaukee Public Museum with a grant. And what is this grant going to do, and how does it work into the research that you're already doing?
So the NSF grant that we just received will fund a project called Terrestrial Parasite Tracker. And this project is going to be focused on digitizing parasite specimens stored in natural history collections across the United States. And so parasite, as you mentioned, is a broad term that's used to describe many different kinds of organisms. And that could be applied to plants or fungi, worms, other animals, and even protozoans.
I didn't even think of plants as being parasitical.
There are parasitic plants, yes.
Wow.
But the Terrestrial Parasite Project is going to be focused on insect parasites and their relatives, specifically those that occur on land as opposed to water, and also groups that we often refer to as being ectoparasites, so occurring on the organism rather than inside of an organism, which would be an endoparasite.
Ah, okay.
And so examples of the kinds of organisms that fall into this category that we will be working with are fleas, lice, mosquitoes, and other biting flies, ticks, and mites.
All of our friends.
Right.
Yes.
And in terms of geographic scope for the project, we're going to be focusing on the North American species. So that's right around 3,000 species for this project.
And I know that you have a lot of samples at the Milwaukee Public Museum. You're also going to be working with other collections around the state, too, right? Isn't there, at UW-Stevens Point, they have
right.
some,
yep.
Madison has
yep.
some?
Yep, University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point and University of Wisconsin at Madison are involved in the project, along with support for 20 other natural history collections and research collections in the United States. So we are going to be working with folks from the University of Hawaii to the University of Florida, folks from Texas A&M to the University of Minnesota, a Cal Academy all the way to the University of New Hampshire.
How exciting.
Right. And the idea there is, you know, we really want to capture the geographic extent of these parasitic species. And we want to be sure that when it comes to potential invasive parasite species that may come into our borders, that we include the collections in places like Hawaii and Texas and Florida.
So what is the money going to allow you to do that you haven't been able to do so far?
Right. So a lot of these collections, you know, are stored in different spaces, different physical spaces. And so, for example, you might have an institution that has an entomology collection in the entomology department, and there might be a parasitology collection housed in, say, the veterinary school. And so one of the big things that this project is going to allow us to do is pull those collections together in a way that is searchable and in a digital format. This project is also going to allow us to connect the data associated with parasite collections to data that we have that can be connected to their hosts. And so we'll be able to do a search on a particular animal host and pull up all of the information on what types of parasites may be associated with that
and
animal.
And if you see something new, you can say, wait a minute, we haven't seen that.
Right.
This is different.
Right, right. And and having all of this information in one place will allow us to generate distribution maps. It'll allow us to generate species checklists that might even, you know, have annotations about where a given harmful parasite or species might occur. Right now, we don't have that information all in one place. And so if we want to know where a harmful parasite species occurs or even where it doesn't occur, you know, we can't access that information easily.
Right. There's no Google that's going to pull that up for you.
Not in a way that's actually geographically comprehensive, right? If you find a tick on your dog, you want to know, do I need to be concerned about this species, right? Well, it would be very useful to be able to pull up your phone and take a picture of that organism and have some information about, you know, what it is and whether or not it's harmful, and if so, what should you do about it?
So how long is getting this, it's almost like a digitized library set up. What's the time frame for all of this?
Right. So the project will start September 1st, and it's a three-year effort. There are a lot of different components, you know, besides just, you know, gathering specimen label data to generate distribution maps and checklists. We're also going to be taking a massive number of images of specimens. And so, you know, this advanced imaging technology is going to require a lot of upfront training and coordinating among participants in the network and various staff members. But we will be taking images of specimens on pins. We will be taking images of specimens mounted on slides. We'll be taking images of specimens stored in vials with fluids. And so in terms of the workload that needs to be spread out over those 3 years, you know, we'll have our hands full. We're also hoping to develop some smartphone apps that will help accelerate species identification. We are also going to be working a lot on, you know, sort of building consensus around standards for how to handle this type of data. We really want this data to be research ready at the end of the 3 year period. And so we'll be having a lot of workshops and discussions with folks involved in the network and also other collaborators outside of the network to be sure that we're making good decisions about how we're organizing the data that we're generating as a part of this project so that it's easily accessible when it's over.
So at the end of the 3 years is the idea that it will there will be some continuation of like maintenance and addition of data to the I'm calling it a library, but to the what is the proper term? What would it be? It's kind of like this national database, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. And so we have a data portal that we are using as a primary aggregator, you know, where this data will live, as you say. And, you know, we're working all the time to come up with long-term solutions in the context of sustainability of the data that we're generating. It's a massive undertaking, you know, figuring out where the data will go, how it will be delivered, where will we store the images, how will we organize them so that we can find them later for downstream research and for development of these identification tools and brochures and field guides that we hope will be very useful to non-specialists, land managers, folks working on invasive species risk assessment, things like that.
So besides yourself, how many people at NPM are going to be involved working on this project?
So we have right now six folks that will be involved in this project. There will be some additional new hires as we move forward. And I think that the people that we have that are going to be working on this project are seasoned veterans in the land of natural history collections digitization. And, you know, the fact that the Milwaukee Public Museum has prioritized digitization for, you know, the past several years just means that we already have an experienced team sort of built into this. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that we got this award to begin with, is because the museum just does such a great job. And we can serve as a really great model for how to make a big project like this successful.
I assume that once the digitization has happened, that the actual physical specimens aren't going anywhere. They're still going to be available.
That's correct. Right. And to that point, this project hopefully will uncover specimens that, you know, are hidden in places where, you know, we didn't know they existed. We also hope to pull in some collections from, you know, researchers who have their sort of their own laboratory parasite collections. We're hoping to get those digitized and made available as a part of this project and help those folks organize those specimens and get them sort of maybe a more permanent home once they're, you know, wrapping up various research projects that require examination of that material.
Right. And I was going to say that you standardize everything so that people can find it in the future as well.
Right. And yeah. I think collections standardization is, you know, obviously something that our community, the collections community, does very well. You know, we've been doing it for over 100 years, which makes this such a tremendous resource, right? That material and data is available. But we also need to think about standards for how we're going to push this information into that digital format and make it consistent and useful for all of the things that we'd like to do with it later. And so that requires a lot of thinking ahead. How do we want to use this for research? And then we have to let that sort of guide us as we work to take the physical collections and make them digital.
You have a lot of really interesting work ahead of you for these next 3 years. I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us, and best of luck with all the work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jennifer Zaspel is the Milwaukee Public Museum's research curator and the head of zoology. We first spoke to her earlier this summer. Coming up next, we speak with a young pastor working in Milwaukee communities from the homeless to youth groups. Andre Pirtle joins us next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. A day in the life of Andre Pirtle can range from delivering water to Milwaukee's homeless, to leading youth groups at Emmanuel Church in Brookfield, where he's a pastor, to working with the outreach group Street Life. Not yet 30 years old, Pirtle has dedicated his life to serving Milwaukee's communities and to lifting people out of the pressures that he once faced himself. Whether it's as a social worker, a pastor, a life coach, or at times a first responder, Pirtle says it all comes down to connecting with someone through conversation. In August, he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio for a conversation about his work.
Andre Pirtle, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's awesome to be here on this semi-warm day. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you in here. So you are the feature in this month's Milwaukee magazine. It describes you as a pastor, social worker, life coach, first responder, lots of descriptions, lots of jobs. How would you say you describe yourself?
Honestly, I'm just a kid from Milwaukee. Like, I don't think there's anything special about me. I think we all see problems. Sometimes we walk over them, and sometimes we just try to, I don't even want to say fix them, we try to work on them. And I'm just a person who just want to work on a few issues that I see. So, no, I'm not special at all. The people around me are special, and I think they think I am, but it's really them.
Yeah, so you're involved in a lot of different organizations, things you do on your own. So how about we give listeners a little example? What's the day in the life of Andre Bertel?
To be honest, just being like straight up, it really depends on the day. I work in different communities, and different communities have different, not just cultures, but different things that are important to them, different ways of doing things, and different time frames they work. So one community, you know, they might not wake up or work until 12 in the afternoon, right? But another community might start early. So I guess it depends on the day, but this is an example of how my whole night could switch. So usually I do street life, and street life is when we work with the men and women who are homeless, men and women who are human trafficked, because it is men and women, and just work with people who don't have housing for that night, or just in general. So as I'm preparing to go there, I get a phone call saying that one of my youth group kids, and this is one that I mentor, has been in my house, has pet my dog. he's missing. And he didn't come to youth group that night, and we looked for him prior. We just thought he was at a park. So from about maybe 9:30 to maybe some point after 12 o'clock, we were looking for this kid. So that starts off my day, but because I did that, I didn't do street life. But either way it was going, I wouldn't have been out that late regardless whether I was working with men and women we know or if it would have just been finding Noah, which we did. And a huge shout out to Milwaukee because a lot of people helped out. People stopped me who I didn't know and just said, "Hey, Andre, we know you from Facebook. We're looking for that kid right now."
So you did eventually find him.
Yes, and then, yes, we did.
Then did you try and, like, backtrack and kind of go back on the main road of where your day would have gone had you not gotten that phone call? You volunteer, you know, helping out the homeless population. You got the youth group. Mm-hmm. You're a pastor at a church. So
yep.
I imagine you are just dealing with a lot of people of all different ages, of all different situations.
I am. But it's a group of us. So I think I get a lot of credit because I'm probably the most charismatic one. And be honest, I'm probably just the youngest one. So You're supposed to pass the buck off to, or pass it off to the next generation.
Right.
I'm just a kid that they pass it off to.
Well, and on that note, being a younger activist and worker and person in the community, and having faced some of the same pressures of a lot of people you help in this city, I'm curious, where does your drive come from to be involved in this kind of work so young and to take a leadership position in it?
I think that, I really believe this, I think that a lot of times, people don't have a person to be solid or be consistent with them, right? And so one of the things, I learned this at an early age, I'm dyslexic. So if I didn't have somebody there every day to help me read words like and the, and even the big words at that time for me, like difficult, if I didn't have someone there every day, my life would have been dramatically different. And I want to be that. I want to be consistent in people's lives. I want to be consistent in the work I do. And if I'm just being honest about it, I believe in a higher power. I believe that what we do on earth in some way, shape, or form, and I don't know what it's going to look like in another plane, but I believe that we answer for these things. And I think that as a kid, I would spill milk. And if I would walk over that spilt milk and go outside and play, when I came home, my mom would have a few choice words for me. Why didn't you pick that up? You had the strength to do it. I think people are the same way. I think, and on the other side, I might be asked, "Hey, Andre, you seen that guy? He was going through something. Why didn't you talk to him?" So for me, it echoes into my afterlife, too.
What would you say is your most valuable tool or resource that helps you not just manage the challenges of your various jobs, but connect with others on that personal level? You mentioned consistency is a big point. What else would you say?
Relationships. Like, everything boils down to a relationship. Like, as much as we're dealing with, or I have the, and they give me, let me say, they give me an awesome opportunity to assist in their issue. They're the master of their own face. They have the keys. But the relationships we establish They realize that I'm not necessarily dealing with their issue. I'm dealing with a person. We're working with a person. We're living life together. And, like, the relationship aspect of thing, if you lose that, then everything falls by the wayside. Because it's not just, it's not a pastor just come up to you, praise the Lord, saints. No, it's your friend. It's a companion, someone who wants you to be better than where you are or to just see you thrive. And it's that relationship aspect of things that helps me, because a lot of times I'm not doing things alone. You know, there's people who I work with who want to work with me. So delegation is cool, but partnership is better for me. So, and that's what we do a lot. So that's out of relationships.
You first got a little spark of the counselor life at a YMCA summer camp.
Yes.
It was when you were first introduced.
Yes.
So
yes.
Did you think that that first summer of doing that would spark your journey to becoming a pastor, becoming a community activist?
No, not at all. I think that, like, so I got out of my neighborhood because there were things going on in my neighborhood.
The Woodlawn neighborhood, right?
Yep, the Woodlands, yeah.
Yeah, Woodlands.
There were things going on at that time that I had no business being a part of, and I just needed escape. I think we all need a break, whether that's mentally or physically. And I got out, but it gave me, like, this awesome opportunity to just experience people. I think it's different when people, when they believe in you. And I had a group of people who believed in me, and I think that sparked all of this. But even, like, just being in nature, it sparked the conversation of, you know, do I have purpose? Is there a higher power? And if it is, what's my role? But I never expected to be a pastor. I laugh about it some days, and I cry about it some days. I never saw it. I never saw this even being a possibility. So it wasn't like plan A, B, or C. No, it was like, it wasn't even on the radar. It wasn't even one of the alphabetical letters for me. So,
what were you most nervous or concerned about when you first started counseling at YMCA? You know, before any of this stuff came, what was your main concern?
It was the first time, actually the second time outside of babysitting and my sister, it was the first time that I was responsible for a life. And if something happens to this child on my watch, then, you know, I got to own that, you know, not just with the parents, but even in my, you know, with my self-esteem. So I was nervous of teaching the kids the wrong thing, because I didn't always know what the parents taught. And I don't want to do anything counterproductive to what a parent is teaching their child. But I also didn't want my goofy 17-year-old tendencies to rub off on a 12-year-old, and they're doing the things I'm doing because I'm unsure of who I am. So I just didn't want to lead kids in the wrong direction. That's honestly still one of my biggest fears, leading people in the wrong direction.
Well, and as a, you know, a pastor, you work at Emmanuel Church,
yep.
And mentoring obviously played a big role in your life when you took on that mantle, but also the people who have helped you. And I want to touch upon Max Ramsey real quick. So he's the one who kind of brought you into the church and helped shape your role as a pastor. So how has the relationship with him influenced what you do, how you view things in a different perspective with your work?
You know, I could say so much about Max, you know, Max is one of my best friends. I love this guy, you know. And he's influenced me in so many different ways where the literature I read, my viewpoint, I dress better than him, so not style. But he's had such a big impact on my life. Not too often do you get, you know, people who are set in their career. Like, Max didn't need to help me out, if we're being honest. Max could have retired. Max could retire right now and his legacy is beautiful, but he gambled on me. He gambled on a kid from the inner city, but it went back to that camp mentality. I don't want to let this guy down. And not just him, but my father. Max and my father know each other, you know, and there's a mutual respect. And I just didn't want to let this guy down, but he saw something in me that sometimes I still struggle to see in myself, and he believed in me, so he's a huge influence on my life. Huge. He's Batman and I'm Robin.
So it seems that, you know, you often are interacting with at-risk, transient populations, kids who need that mentor in their life, that support, that person who is consistent. What are the biggest misconceptions about the people you reach out to and work with every day that you'd like the public to push aside?
Laziness. I think that the population of people I work with, one of the populations, they are assumed to be lazy. And I don't think people understand the effects of generational, being broken down for generations. Example, so if your grandfather went to college, or maybe he didn't, maybe went to a trade school because of the era, right? Odds are your father or your went to college, right? So odds are you'll go to school. But what if your grandfather were disenfranchised and had no wealth to pass down to your, to the son, and the father was never able to pass that down to you? So I think a lot of times we inherit things from our parents, and what happens when your parents don't have a lot to inherit to you? And I also think people have been beat down for generations to where it's hard for them to even contemplate certain things as far as, you know, making it out. You go to the things that people around you have gone to. And if no one has ever went to school, if no one has ever made it out of the neighborhood you come out of, why would you have ambitions? Because you've never even seen it happen around you to make it out. And I think a lot of times that gets confused as being lazy. And a lot of times it's just a lack of direction. And probably the biggest one, resources. If all communities had the same resources, it'd be a different ballgame. But all communities don't. And I think that's a big misconception.
In the article, you're quoted as saying, sometimes it starts with a simple conversation. Mm-hmm. What kind of conversations do you think the people of Milwaukee should be having with each other?
Oh, man, redlining? What is redlining? And why does that exist? And why did it exist? And not just that, but does that still affect us today? What does poverty look like? I think conversations about the trade school should open up. I think conversations about equal pay for women should open up. I think, and probably this is a huge one, conversations about mental health. Mental health needs to be spoken about, and it's a taboo right now, and it doesn't have to be. When you get a cut in your foot, you know where to go. But when you're going through something psychologically, where do you go? And if you don't know where to go, that's what we need to be talking about. So for me, those are the things I need to be talking about. And also the homeless population, how do we support them? And what does support even look like? And that's just a few of my ideas about what I think we should be speaking about.
Some of these challenges and issues obviously have persisted over time, you know, such as the homeless population, poverty, gun violence here in the city. What's your greatest concern or fear if a trend continues unchanged?
If it continues to be unchanged? Well, it becomes a part of our culture. That becomes the norm. When trends stay in place for a long period of time, we adapt those and say that's just a part of who we are. And I don't think that's the case in all scenarios.
With your work, you are probably out, 12 hours a day, work days?
Some days, yeah. Some days 12, some days shorter, some days longer. Being honest, it just depends on the day. Between my father and Max, they've taught me it's not about the hours you put in, it's about what you do in those hours. So I can put in 24 hours in a full day, but if the job didn't get done, what's the point? If I didn't chip something off of the block, it doesn't matter. So I kind of was trained to work until completion.
How do you manage to take care of yourself in the midst of all the demands that are asked of you and the situations you go through and the emotional investment you put into your everyday?
So I got a fine wife. So hanging with her, to be honest with you. Letting people invest in me. I didn't know how to do that at first. I knew how to give, but it took me years to realize I need to receive. And I think that allowing people to do that, not denying them that, because when you deny people the opportunity to give, you deny them of sometimes their gifting. Maybe their gifting is giving. When you say no, they sit there like, what do I do now? And I think researching how to eat, I think it's therapeutic. Researching history, I really love history. Working out, praying and really reading the Bible, but also, like I said, different forms of literature. So those are the things that help me out. They soothe either my mind, my body, or my spirit. So those are the things I try to keep in constant line from my perspective.
Well, I know you're certainly gifting a lot of things to people within this community, and I want to thank you, Andre, for taking a few minutes out of your day to speak with me about yourself.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Andre Pirtle is a pastor, community activist, mentor, and much more. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in August. We will take one last break, and then theater critic Chris Jones joins us to talk about the evolution of Broadway theater and the incredible impact of Hamilton, an American musical. Be in the room where it happens when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
My name is Alexander Hamilton, and there's a million things I haven't done. Just you wait, just you wait.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The musical Hamilton is a phenomenon. The show tells the story of the birth of the United States with Alexander Hamilton at its center. There is love, sacrifice, and dignity in the face of injustice. The cast is diverse, and the music a combination of hip-hop and more classical musical theater melodies. It is a uniquely American show in theme, casting, and music, and it will shape musical theater for years to come. Chris Jones is the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, and he's the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society from Angels in America to Hamilton. The book makes the case for theater as a means to both respond to the current cultural climate and to provoke conversation. Jones spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year, and he explained why he decided to start his examination of Broadway with Tony Kushner's 1991 opus, Angels in America, A Gay Fantasia on National Themes.
There was this extraordinary play that came out called Angels in America. And what I think was sort of remarkable about it was a couple of things. It was a very political play. So it was the beginning of, I think, Broadway figuring out that it could actually be political, that it could actually promote social change. But the play came out really at the height of the AIDS crisis. And if you were around at that time, you found yourself going to a lot of funerals. And a lot of those funerals were kind of the same. There'd be sort of somebody young would have died. And then in the back, there would be parents who may or may not have really known the person who just died. And they were these very, very wrenching occurrences. And they were happening in very, very quick succession for anyone really involved in culture or the arts at the time. And I think at that point, you know, politics didn't really cut it, that you couldn't survive that era without having some sort of spiritual solution for yourself. And what I thought was remarkable about Angels was how it combined those two things. It was a political play, but it was also a play seeking something, seeking an answer to death, really, which, you know, most great theater ultimately, from Hamlet to Hamilton, is about death and how we transcend it.
When you talk about, you know, politically transformative plays, I always think of, you know, Awake and Sing and
yes.
Death of a Salesman. What were the kind of hit shows that were on Broadway before Angels in America, in those couple decades before that?
Well, in the 1950s and 1960s, there was what you might call a broad middle-class audience for theater in New York, that if you did an Arthur Miller play, people would go. This, of course, was before Netflix and streaming and really before serious TV drama in many ways. And there was definitely, that was an era when people would go to those plays and there would be a sort of a broad consensus about what those plays had to say, kind of broad liberal consensus. And then in the 1960s and 1970s, I think Broadway theater got away from that and it always had been to some degree the theater of spectacle, and musicals in particular became all about escape, and they became all about, you know, relationships. They were not really about issues. And then, you know, slowly but surely, the musical began to kind of find its way. And there's a lot of musicals that were sort of very important. In my book, what I try to do is chart how these musicals got us to Hamilton. And people ask me a lot, what was the other show that was as big a hit as Hamilton? Like what musical compared to it? And my answer is there hasn't been any. Now, A Chorus Line was on the cover of Newsweek when it came out in the 1970s. But, you know, the cover was Donna McKechnie's legs. It wasn't, there had never been a musical that really kind of spoke to the zeitgeist. So I think that Broadway in the 70s and 80s was a bit of a dead zone when it came to engagement and ideas.
So you start with Angels in America, but you go on to talk about, of course, The Normal Heart.
Yes.
Another play that really speaks to that experience. And Rent as well, which kind of bridges, not only deals with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, but also another burgeoning problem at the time, gentrification.
Well, so Rent was this fascinating show, and everyone knows Rent. It was just on TV a couple of weeks ago, as you know. And Rent was sort of fascinating because it was the first musical, really, that was kind of, that dealt with issues of gentrification. And it had irony right at its center because, you know, in the show, you've got Mark and Roger complaining about gentrification in the East Village. And if you go now to the East Village, there it's completely gentrified. There is no, La Vie Boheme has completely vanished. And really, you can half blame Rent because it made it sort of chic. And, you know, when Rent first opened, they came up with this idea of cheap tickets at the front. So all the hipsters would kind of stand in line. This was before the days of internet lottery. So they would be, this was at the Nederlander Theater on 41st Street, and there would be this huge line of grungy-looking young people, and they would all buy these tickets relatively cheaply. And then the real money was made just behind them. So wealthy people would essentially buy those tickets, and it would be just a little edgy, just a little dangerous enough because they'd be right next to these bohemians right in front of them. And so Rent really commercialized the idea of sort of hipster musicals in many ways. And I mean, that's the cynical view of it. It's also, of course, a very, very beautiful show with some of these sort of plaintive melodies and really about the other thing that I think Rent is sort of fascinating is that over the last 20 years, cities have had an enormous comeback. Like, you know, Gen Xers and millennials don't want to move to the suburbs. So everywhere you go, there's a loft apartment in every city. Cities have had a huge comeback. And I think Rent really did have a lot to do with that, the glamorization of the urban life and the creation of the so-called third spaces, the rise of Starbucks, the rise of WeWork, the beginning of the gig economy. You can see a lot of these things going on in Rent. The idea of the underemployed, overeducated artist, which is with us right now, all of that's there in Rent. So I think sociologically, Rent is a really fascinating musical.
I spoke with Taye Diggs.
Yes.
It was when they were doing the 20th anniversary tour
yes.
of Rent.
Yes.
And he was saying, you know, he felt that Rent was as meaningful today as it had been 20 years ago.
Well, I think it, you know, Rent was very much a young person's show when it came out. Like, if you were over 40, you probably went in there and went, you know, they should just pay their rent, you know. But if you were under 40, you were all into it. And I think really it tends to speak to young people, whatever generation it is, because it's, you know, it's about rebellion, but it's also about the search for community and about learning to sort of create your own family from your friends. And I think that was a very, very big part of it. So I think it's a show that people have enormous affection for. Even people who don't know much about the theater tend to really like Rent.
Yeah. Now, you use Hamilton as kind of the entry point for each conversation. In each chapter, you reference it back to Hamilton or what will become Hamilton. What do you think is so unusual and transformative about Hamilton versus the very many musicals that came before it?
So if you're a theater critic, you're used to people going, eyes glazing over when you say what you do. Except for the people who really love theater. And there's good people in Milwaukee and Chicago who really love theater, but there are people that don't. Hamilton has essentially made its way into the national zeitgeist more than any other show in my professional life. Like, everyone wants to see it. Everyone's interested in it. And I had this moment, I guess my moment of revelation was I was in the newsroom at the Tribune, actually, watching the 2016 Tony Awards. And then they go to a commercial break and they come back from a commercial break. And there's Barack Obama, sitting president of the United States, Michelle Obama, first lady of the United States. And they do a little cheesy little video saying, coming up next, Lin-Manuel Miranda in Hamilton. And then they cut to another commercial. And I was thinking to myself, wow, I don't think I've ever seen on an award show a sitting president essentially introduce a nominee. You know, I mean, people talk about the Kennedy administration as being very pro-arts. But that was nothing compared to the sort of the Obama administration's interest in Hamilton. Now, it was unusual because, of course, the genesis of the show was partly at the White House. It had its origins in an event that Miranda and his collaborators did at the White House. But I think in many ways that show represented to the president, to President Obama, and to many people in his administration, it represented what they believed in and what they really stood for. And then the other event that was sort of fascinating to me was, of course, the night when Mike Pence, who was then vice president-elect, so this was after the Hillary Clinton's losing the election, Mike Pence shows up at the theater on Broadway, and they decide to address him from the stage. The cast, that current cast of Rent, decided to address him from the stage. And there were two schools of thought on that. Some people thought that was rude. Shouldn't he be allowed to have an ad at the theater like anyone else? If you or I go to the theater, we don't want to be shouted at, you know, from the stage. And I sort of saw that. I see that argument. But they decided that they were at this political show and they needed to do that. And so they said what they had to say. By all accounts, you know, afterwards Mike Pence was okay about it. He said, look, it's free country, quite decent about it. He listened, off he went, everything was fine. And then his boss, the newly elected Donald Trump, decided that he was not fine about it. And he said, very rude, he tweeted out, very rude, theater should be a safe place. And I think a lot of artists would say, well, no, theater should be a dangerous place by its very nature. But what intrigued me, I suppose, was that if you think of all the controversial tweets that Donald Trump has made in this relatively young administration, the first one that really got attention was the tweet about Hamilton. So here you have a show that was not only was it sort of at the center of the, and these two things are related, but not only was it at the center of the Obama administration, but then it was the show that sort of riled the new president. And so even after the Obama administration, it was still at the center of the discourse. And I'm like, you know, that's hard to do for a piece of theater.
It is. And I think part of it is, of course, the politics, and it's rooted in a political conversation. But it's not the first musical to even involve the founding of our nation,
right?
Obviously, 1776.
That's correct.
Bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson, not the founding of our nation, but another president.
A rather interesting president, yeah.
But what was it about Hamilton that was different? What about the content of the show went a step further than something like 1776?
Well, I think there's a few things that were just unique. And before I say any of this, I don't know that it's repeatable. Like, you know, I don't know that if I then say all this, this is why this show became so big, that you could then go out and do it again. Don't think you could, actually. But be that as it may, for one thing, it sort of had a diverse cast, and it made the diversity of its cast, the fact that the Founding Fathers looked like the rest of America, it made it one of its central calling cards. No show on Broadway had ever done that before, no musical. So that's A, and I think that was a huge part of why it did so well. Secondly, it was about, obviously it was about the first Secretary of the Treasury, so a lot of it had substance and gravitas, and politicians would go and see it, and financiers would go and see it, and people were interested in it beyond the usual musical crowd. So that was something too. But it was also, you know, most theater, I think, does best when it operates on the heart. In other words, it's one thing to be political, but theater, for the most part, requires emotional engagement. Not unlike radio, you might say. It's the same thing. You know, people want to be engaged. They want to hear a story. They want to care about characters. It's really about emotion. And what Hamilton had, of course, was that Alexander Hamilton, lost his kid to a duel. In reality, his kid died. The worst thing you can imagine, as they say in the show, living the unimaginable. And moreover, he lost this kid by the young man essentially wanting to impress his father. So it's a sort of a really horrible personal circumstance where Hamilton, I think in reality and in the show, would have given away all the writing he ever wrote. He would have given all that up to have his kid back. And so it had that story of personal tragedy, which obviously not every presidential biography has. And that made it, I think, that operated on a different level from just a political.
So often theater is, yes, a personal response to what is happening around us. When we look at Angels in America, when we look at Hamilton, they're both responses to our cultural atmosphere at that time.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think a lot of people have talked about in the last few years, specifically an organization out of Chicago, Not in Our House,
yes,
is the climate inside of the theater itself.
Yes.
And I think there are a lot of us who are looking at what's happening on Broadway, in theaters in Chicago and throughout the country, and go, when is theater or is theater going to talk about Me Too? Because you have obviously, you know, big abusers like,
yes,
James Barber, who,
yes,
you know,
yes, yes,
was
right,
imprisoned,
yes,
but continues to work.
Well, I think the theater has had to and still has to sort of examine its own house. I think that is exactly right. One of the issues that the theater faces, of course, is that show business is very difficult to break into. And so what historically has happened is that people, particularly young women, have wanted to break into a very difficult business, and they have felt in some ways coerced into workplace practices that would not be acceptable in any other workplace. And that, I think, is one of the things that the theater really has to come to terms with. It's a position where certain people have absolute power. So if you're an actress auditioning for a show, the person in front of you on the other side of the table can essentially determine whether you work, and indeed, if they give you a really big role, can completely change the trajectory of your life. Now, there's other areas of life where that's sort of true, but in theater, it's a constant. So most people with a regular job, they might go through an interview, and then there they are working in a job for 3 or 4 years. If you're an actor, every few months, you're going through all this again. And of course, Hollywood is exactly the same setup. So I think that's why not just the celebrity of your Kevin Spaceys and your Harveys and all the rest of this. I think it was rife in show business partly because of the nature of show business and this sort of archaic power structure that existed. And I think good work has been done to improve it, but still more needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I loved the book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in.
Right. Bye-bye.
Chris Jones is the chief theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, and he's the author of Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Becky Mortensen, Joy Powers, and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Lauren Sickfason is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend here on listener-supported 89.7 WUW. Milwaukee's NPR.